From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, November 12, 2008. The UN considers sending additional troops to Congo, where some 100,000 refugees have been cut off from basic necessities. We'll hear just how far the government and private banks may go towards lending Main Street a helping hand. And some 10,000 sugarcane cutters in Colombia call an end to a strike after most of their demands are honored. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. That's the sound from New Haven City Hall this morning as gay and lesbians cheered the first same-sex marriages. Today, Connecticut finalized a state Supreme Court decision from September to legalize gay marriage. This morning, a lesbian couple took out the first marriage license that no longer lists the partners as bride and groom. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
Barbara and Robin Levine Ritterman were among the eight same-sex couples whose victory at the Connecticut Supreme Court in September legalized same-sex marriage. The court ruled they had a right to equal protection under the state constitution. The couple had a commitment ceremony 16 years ago and then were joined in a civil union when that became available in Connecticut in 2005. But standing on the steps of New Haven City Hall amidst white balloons, red roses, and supporters wearing big pink I do buttons, Barbara said that wasn't good enough when she went to the hospital for a cancer checkup.
When they said, "What's your marital status?" I said, "Civil union." And she said, "Oh, there's no place for that in the computer. I'll put you down as single," which just made me feel like I was back up there when the chemo almost killed me and worrying whether if I got sent to the intensive care unit, was Robin going to be able to come with me?
The Levine Rittermans haven't set a wedding date yet, but later in the morning, a lesbian couple that was not party to the lawsuit got married at City Hall. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
The U.S. Supreme Court released its first decision of the current term today, siding with the Navy in a case about sonar and its effects on marine mammals. Environmentalists argue the sonar used by submarines and other vessels can cause irreversible damage to dolphins and whales, but the justices determined the need for the Navy to conduct realistic training exercises outweighed the potential for harm. The Navy is now cleared to go forward with testing off the coast of Southern California. The U.S. and Bolivian governments are taking steps to ease their current diplomatic crisis. Lenny Oliveira reports from Bolivia.
The Bolivian government and the U.S. Embassy have agreed to carry out inspections of Drug Enforcement Administration offices throughout Bolivia. The announcement came after a meeting in La Paz between the U.S. Embassy and Bolivian ministers. Relations between two countries broke down on November 1st when President Evo Morales suspended the work of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency in Bolivia, saying that agency's officials were planning to undermine his administration. The objective of the inspections is to find information to confirm those suspicions. The inspections will be carried out the 14th and 15th of November, led by high-ranking Bolivian police and the Interior Minister. Bolivia is also setting up its own internal agency to fight drug trafficking. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Oliveira from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Another school building has collapsed in Haiti today following heavy rains. The building came down while classes were in session and injured 9 people. This is the second school to collapse in a week. The first, last Friday, killed nearly 90. Human rights groups are criticizing the junta of Myanmar, or Burma, for handing down 65-year sentences to 14 activists. Amnesty International claims they are among 2,000 political prisoners in Burma's jails. FSRN's Claudia Cragg reports.
Those sentenced are part of the Generation 88 students group being punished for their activities during the so-called Saffron Revolution, a monk-led uprising in Burma last year. Speaking to FSRN, David Matheson of Human Rights Watch said he is not surprised that so far there appears to be no reaction within Burma.
These harsh sentences and this intense intimidation is meant to scare the population so that they won't protest, so that they won't actually challenge the military government.
Matheson is calling for the UN to rise to the challenge of showing how unfair the jail terms are.
It's ludicrous that some people are facing 150 years in prison in some 22 trumped-up charges for doing nothing more than marching peacefully down the street and calling for dialogue with the military government for sustainable reform.
Meanwhile, a prominent labour rights activist, Susu Nwe, has also been sentenced to 12 and a half years for a poem criticising General Tan Shui, and a 28-year-old blogger has been given 20 years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Claudia Cragg.
And mediation talks have broken down today between Russia and the United States over a proposed missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic. Russia has countered with threats of its own missile deployment on the border of Poland. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The UN Security Council will likely approve the deployment of an additional 3,000 UN troops to eastern Congo. Some 17,000 troops are already on the ground, mandated to protect civilians and disarm rebels. Neighboring Angola has also pledged to send troops to counter rebel leader Laurent Nkunda's estimated 10,000 fighters. The rebels and government troops now stand accused of extreme violence, including separating children from their families and forcing them to serve as soldiers, forcing labor at gunpoint, and rape. At least 100,000 civilians have been displaced and cut off from basic necessities. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for an immediate truce to allow aid workers to reach the refugees.
Because of the ongoing fighting, these people have received virtually no assistance. Their situation has grown increasingly desperate. I urgently call for an immediate ceasefire in these areas to allow humanitarian assistance to reach many thousands of displaced persons. We remain caught in a very volatile and dangerous moment for the DRC and for the region.
Juliet Pradhan is the Congo director for Oxfam. She's on the ground in Goma and says additional UN troops will help secure the mandate to protect civilians so that humanitarian aid can reach those in need.
Those troops will enable the UN to secure key areas, key towns and cities, and free up other forces to be able to go out to areas where people are most in need, to areas of uncertainty on the front line. At the moment, in the front line, just outside of Goma, 10, 11 kilometers outside of Goma, we've got the UN troops forming a buffer between the government and rebel fighters. And that in itself helps to stabilize the situation, and is part of the reason why things have not shifted on that front for a short space of time. But that's just one of the fronts that exists. And while the troop numbers are not sufficient for the mandate that exists, there's 3,000 troops that will help that kind of physical protection to happen in more areas, but it will also free up troops, as I say, to patrol areas near to the conflict zones where there are displaced people desperately in need of some kind of protection and refuge. And in addition, it will help to stabilize areas enough so that we as humanitarian agencies can actually get out to reach the people who need our assistance, which we can't do right now.
Juliet, what would a proper solution, look like in Goma and in Congo now?
Okay, well, we need to look at the immediate term, which is about stabilizing the solution. So we need an immediate ceasefire, and a ceasefire that's going to hold, which is easier said than done, but we need that now. We need to have more troops and able to stabilize the situation, for sure. But the answers to this problem have to lie with the Congolese themselves and with the international community and strong support to the Congolese to finding those solutions. We need peace agreements that are going to hold, but we need the resources to enable those peace agreements to hold. So we're going to need the stable government structures all the way out into the provinces where they need to be. We need police that are adequately resourced and who know how to do their job. We need military who are well-trained and well-disciplined. And we need some form of justice for all of the perpetrators of the human rights abuses that are going on in and around this conflict. So it's not a simple solution. It's a long-term solution that we need. But the message right now, what we need immediately is for the fighting to stop and for more troops in country to enable that to happen, more UN troops.
Congo Director for Oxfam, Juliet Pradhan, she spoke to us from Goma. The UN Security Council will decide this evening on whether to send additional troops to Congo. France attempted but failed to convince the EU to send 1,500 troops to work alongside the UN. Voters in Jerusalem have elected a secular mayor, swiftly putting an end to ultra-Orthodox rule in the holy city. Although the majority of Jerusalem's Arab residents, who make up about a third of the population, boycotted this election, Mayor-elect Nir Barkat says he will serve everyone, the Jews, the Arabs, the religious, and the secular. Meanwhile, increased violence between the Israeli army and Hamas fighters in Gaza may put an end to an already fragile truce. The latest skirmish began when Israeli troops fired on men they say were installing a bomb near the border fence. The troops fired and killed four militants. This as Hamas and Fatah are blaming each other for the failure of a scheduled Cairo-hosted National Unity Conference. FSRN's Rami Al-Megari has more.
Four Palestinian fighters of the ruling Hamas party were found killed near the border fence with Israel in southern Gaza, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. The Al-Qassam Brigade, Hamas's armed wing, says the four were killed while they were defending an Israeli invasion in the Al-Qarara town. Israeli army sources say an Israeli drone spotted a group of militants planting explosive devices near the Gaza border fence with Israel. The attack on Gaza comes days after a failed unity conference scheduled in Cairo. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah slammed the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, saying Hamas was responsible for the conference failure and calling on Arab states to hold Hamas responsible. Hamas refuses to participate in such a dialogue unless the Abbas-led Palestinian Authority stops the arrests of its West Bank-based members. Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh describes Abbas's remarks as hostile. Amir Ibrahim is a Gaza political analyst.
If we reach a point of no dialogue and no solution to the problem, there will be no other consequences, and then it will be difficult for the parties to meet. The only chance for them is the time period from now until January 2009. If they fail to meet, there will be an Arab, a regional, or even an Israeli stance towards what's going on now between Ramallah and Gaza, and things will not remain the same as they are now.
Some humanitarian workers are concerned that today's violence may affect this week's scheduled opening of Gaza border crossings, during which the UN brings in food and other supplies to Palestinians who have been cut off by the Israeli blockade. Gaza residents, meanwhile, are still hopeful that national unity talks will lead to better living conditions. Mohammed Al-Rifai is a Gaza resident.
The Palestinian people are the main group affected by this situation, and as a Palestinian resident, I appeal to both factions to achieve conciliation. By doing so, we will embarrass our enemy as well as those who are against peace in the region.
The rival Hamas and Fatah parties were expected to end their division and develop a national unity government that ends an internationally enforced boycott and a debilitating Israeli blockade of Gaza, where Hamas holds power. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Megari in Gaza.
In Argentina, workers who took over their workplaces to safeguard their jobs are rallying today to fight against state-imposed evictions. FSRN's Marie Trigona has the story from Buenos Aires.
More than 10,000 workers are employed by Argentina's 180 worker-occupied factories. And now many of these recuperated enterprises are facing eviction threats, with local and national government unwilling to grant laws in favor of worker self-management. Hotel Bowen is one example. The 19-story, 180-room hotel has been operational since workers took it over in 2003. National Deputy Victoria Donda presented a bill in Argentina's National Congress earlier this year for a national expropriation law for Hotel Bowen. She said in a press conference that congressional representatives are taking too long to debate the bill, putting the 160 jobs at risk.
Hace cuatro meses nosotros presentamos en el proyecto de ley para declarar este lugar de trabajo.
4 months ago, we presented a bill, a law to declare this workplace, which already belongs to the community in Buenos Aires, to declare it public domain. We are going to continue to fight so that the law is passed before the end of the year.
Fabio Rossino is a worker from the Bauen Cooperative. He says fears over imminent job losses in Argentina's economy, spiraled by the deepening global crisis, may be fueling the government's refusal to back worker-occupied factories.
Bauen's situation is not an isolated process. It's an attack to stop an open process which began in 2000 when workers took over businesses that the former bosses were emptying out. Now is a very critical moment for the country, where the global crisis could cause factory closures and mass firings like we have been seeing. For many of those in power, it is not convenient to have the example of the recuperated enterprises, which is why the recovery of businesses and worker self-management is being attacked.
Other recuperated enterprises, including Fatsin Pat Ceramics Plant and the Rabioni Transport Co-op, also face eviction. But workers plan to continue their fight. Thousands are expected for today's street festival for a national expropriation law for Hotel Bauen and other recuperated enterprises, where Argentine rock legend León Gieco will perform. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona from Buenos Aires.
Sugarcane cutters are back at work in Colombia today after a long strike that began in September. An estimated 10,000 cutters demanded better wages and improved work conditions. As Manuel Rueda reports from Bogotá, most of those demands were met.
The union said the 10,000 sugarcane workers were being treated like slaves, working 12 hours a day in scorching temperatures and earning under $10 a day. The workers also wanted to change their employment status, from contracted workers to full-time employees with greater health benefits and vacation pay. The strike's economic impact was so significant that President Uribe urged both sides to make a deal.
We must construct fraternal labor relations. There cannot be savage capitalism or class hatred in labor relations.
This weekend, unions brokered deals at most of the sugar mills that were on strike. Television crews filmed the workers' celebrations.
The price we get paid per ton of cane went up significantly, because before they would pay us an extra 10 or 20 cents per year. Now we are getting an extra 50 or 60 cents. This was a great struggle, a resistance struggle.
Workers were also offered housing credit, funds for education, and a 9-hour working day. But they failed to gain full-time employee status and company health coverage. Union leader Daniel Aguirre says they used to have these benefits in the 90s, before the implementation of neoliberal reforms.
I think that if all 13 mills would have gone on strike, we could have fought for full employee status. But the problem was that 5 mills did not obey the strike order. So that destabilized our process and it helped the mills avoid negotiating direct contracts.
The sugar industry says that hiring cane cutters as full-time employees would make it impossible for Colombian mills to compete with sugar exports from nearby countries where land is cheaper and wages are lower, like Brazil. But unions say they will continue to push for more stable working conditions by lobbying Congress to make new labor laws. Sugar mills are highly profitable, and economists say the government gives them more than $100 million a year in tax breaks. Unions feel that employers are not sharing the wealth. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogota.
Despite continued insecurity on Wall Street, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson insisted today that the bailout has clearly helped stabilize the U.S. financial system. However, he did acknowledge the continued fragility in the U.S. and abroad and announced what the Treasury has in store for the remaining bailout funds. Paulson said the Treasury has identified three critical priorities. First, to give both banks and non-banks more funds to offset their troubled asset holdings. Second, to fund markets that securitize credit outside of the banking system, including those that secure auto and school loans. And third, to explore ways to reduce the risk of foreclosure. Well, remember when government officials promised to help out not just Wall Street, but Main Street? A major piece of that plan was to help homeowners facing foreclosure. Mortgage and banking companies are stepping up to modify loans that borrowers can't pay, and the government has announced plans to do its part, too. FSRN's Tanya Snyder takes a look at how far this relief may go.
The subprime mortgage crisis bears a big part of the blame for the Wall Street meltdown and the recession. People who had borrowed money they couldn't pay back under unrealistic terms defaulted in large numbers. When banks lost money on these defaulted loans, the government bailed them out. But millions of homeowners facing foreclosure have yet to see how these billions of bailout dollars will help them. Some lenders are finally stepping up to modify the loans. Molly Sheehan works in the home lending division of JPMorgan Chase.
We will work with families who want to save their homes but are struggling to make their payments. That's why we announced on October 31st that we are undertaking multiple new initiatives designed to keep more families in their homes.
JPMorgan Chase plans to lower interest rates and temporarily reduce loan balances. They also plan to open homeowner counseling centers around the country. Bank of America and Citigroup have announced similar measures. And Tuesday, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac announced a program to help as many as 300,000 families in danger of losing their homes. Their program will also modify mortgages by reducing interest rates. The goal is for the monthly payment to be no greater than 38% of the borrower's gross monthly income. Jim Campen is the director of Americans for Fairness in Lending. He says the moves by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the private banks don't go far enough.
What they'll do sometimes is reduce the monthly payment. Sometimes they'll stretch the loan from 30 years to 40 years to get the monthly payment lower. Sometimes they'll temporarily lower the interest rate. But very seldom do they mark down the value of the loan to what's consistent to what the borrower can pay, which will allow the home to avoid foreclosure and therefore save the homeowner the eviction and to save the bank the greater losses they would get if they were foreclosed.
Campen says that of all the different prescriptions for loan modification, the only one that really makes a dent in foreclosure rates is principal modification, and that isn't what the mortgage lenders are offering. Fannie and Freddie's program also won't help holders of subprime mortgages, which have a default rate about 15 times greater than standard mortgages, which they will be focusing on. Some lawmakers also say the scope of the program, the number of families they're seeking to help, is too small. There are countless barriers to a loan modification program that would really address the problem. Some homeowners have experienced changes like unemployment or divorce that lower their incomes so much that no amount of modification will allow them to keep their homes. Different rules also govern modifications due to bankruptcy. Jim Campen says current laws allow people with vacation homes and investment properties and even yachts to reduce the value of their mortgages, to cram them down to what they can actually pay.
The only kind of asset, really, that can't be crammed down or the principal amount modified in a bankruptcy proceeding is an owner-occupied home. It's completely irrational, completely unfair.
Congressional Democrats and President-elect Obama have indicated their willingness to change the rules that govern modifications due to bankruptcy. Another barrier to loan modification is securitization, or the bundling of mortgages. It's one thing to determine the parameters for a loan modification for one loan, but when they're pooled, it's nearly impossible to separate them out for individual solutions. And so mortgage servicing companies have been far less willing than direct lenders to work toward modification. Barney Frank, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, says they might have to be forced.
We have not seen servicers participating in any significant way. And I believe we now have a situation that requires legislation.
Other governmental programs have attempted to chip away at the foreclosure problem and failed. The Hope for Homeowners initiative started at the beginning of October with $300 billion from Congress. The program, administered by the Federal Housing Administration, was supposed to take over troubled mortgages from lenders. The government, the lender, and the homeowner would then share future appreciation on the home's value. But in the first 2 weeks of the program, only 42 lenders applied. The FHA has now slashed its projections about how many people it will help. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
President-elect Obama will place health care as a top priority once he enters office, and Congress, meanwhile, is getting a head start. Democratic Senator Max Baucus laid out a plan for reform today. It would cover everyone, including the 47 million currently uninsured. The plan, however, falls short of creating a single-payer, government-run system. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has the details.
The last time major health reform was attempted was in 1993. Democratic President Bill Clinton thought that with the Democratic Congress, the time was right for major change. It failed. This election day resurrected a similar scenario with some different players. Democrats are feeling optimistic. Senator Max Baucus of Montana is banking on Democratic rule to pass health reform quickly.
Change is coming, and this is where I believe we should start.
The central component of Baucus's plan would be to cover all Americans and reduce costs. It's a mix of private and public components to ensure 47 million uninsured and the thousands more on the verge of losing their health insurance through job loss or rising costs. The cost of Baucus's plan is currently unknown, but Baucus, who heads the Finance Committee, which determines how to pay for it, calls it an investment.
The time has passed for us to nickel and dime our American healthcare system.
Baucus would expand government programs, Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and the Indian Health Service to ensure more elderly, disabled, low-income, children, and Native Americans are covered. For those who still won't see coverage, they'll receive a subsidy to buy a private plan, and small business employees can opt into a nationwide insurance pool.
It's comprehensive. It's real reform. It's bold. It would bring the uninsured into coverage.
That was Rick Curtis. He's president of the Institute of Health Policy Solutions. Michael Leidy is director of public policy for the California Nurses Association and member of Progressive Democrats of America.
This must be a new political day if Max Baucus is proposing the expansion of public health programs, specifically Medicare and Medicaid.
But Leidy and Progressive Democrats of America say the central tool for coverage is flawed. They advocate a single-payer health system.
It still subsidizes private insurance, and it still relies upon the private health insurance industry, which is, of course, denying people care, not providing the care that we need, and in fact, wasting taxpayers' money.
Baucus has just outlined his proposal. The legislation is not yet written. He says he'll work with Senator Ted Kennedy and Senator Hillary Clinton, who both have worked on health care reform for many years. And, of course, he must work with President-elect Obama. Baucus's plan does differ from Obama's plan in one major way. Obama has said on the campaign trail he opposes a requirement that all people buy health insurance. Although the Democrats have the White House and large majorities in the House and the Senate, Republicans will likely have to be included. They've expressed opposition to expansion of government health programs. Sure to also have a stake, doctors, nurses, pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and small businesses who could be affected by major reforms. Joel White is executive director of the Coalition of Affordable Health Coverage. It's a coalition that includes many of the above-mentioned groups.
This is just the first stage in the process. Again, it's a blueprint. It's not a bill or a piece of legislation, and as folks know, the devil's in the details. So a lot of folks, including our group, are going to be taking a look at the details, working with Senator Baucus and others in the Senate to make sure that we get a quality product.
Any group that could lose money in the reform will likely put up a major fight. It's a fight Democrats hope to conclude with passage of legislation by mid-2009. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You have been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editors are Jess Burns and Nell Abram. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katabchi, Puck Lowe, and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.